I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Jane Lindholm. Over the past three legislative sessions, elected officials have devoted more money than ever to clean up Vermont's lakes, ponds, and rivers. In this past session, lawmakers and the governor finally created a long-term revenue source that's going to ensure that funding is available for the long haul. But talk to folks who tried to go swimming earlier this month at North Beach in Burlington or Red Rocks in South Burlington, and they'll tell you it's far from mission accomplished when it comes to cleaning up Vermont's waterways. Today in VPR's Colchester studio, we're joined by Julie Moore, the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources in Vermont. Julie, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Julie, I want to start with a post that came in from Robin on Facebook, because this show, the reason we're doing it right now, is in part inspired by some of the blue-green algae blooms that have again reared their head in Vermont. Robin wants to says, We changed our plans years ago when we are no longer going to the lake or any ponds that have had this algae problem. It isn't worth taking the chance, she says. How concerned do people need to be about their own health and safety when it comes to Vermont water, given this new problem?
Absolutely. Harmful algal blooms are a significant environmental problem, and they're not limited to Vermont. EPA has indicated that there's evidence of algal blooms in all 50 states. They take different forms in some places than they take here, but cyanobacteria populations are very widespread and can have those impacts on human health, aquatic ecosystems, and frankly, our economy. We do a lot of work trying to educate the public on how to identify blue-green algae blooms, understand when they should stay out of the water and look for another place to recreate. By and large, though, Lake Champlain's rivers, lakes all throughout Vermont are safe for swimming most of the time. And it's just having that awareness of when there is a bloom in progress and the need to stay out of the water.
Elected officials and the governor collaborated this past legislative session to finally come up with a long-term funding mechanism for the money it's going to take to solve Vermont's water quality problems, or at least make progress on them. Why is this law so critical to Vermont being able to control its clean water destiny?
Sure. So in order to achieve our water quality goals for the state of Vermont, it's going to require a significant investment. In 2017, the treasurer completed an evaluation and estimated it would take $2 billion over the next 20 years worth of investment in these important assets to achieve our water quality goals. This past session, we worked with the legislature and came to agreement on a funding package that, all told, by the time we're able to draw down some federal funds and other pieces, will result in an investment of state dollars of between $50 and $60 million a year for the next 20 years. And it's this magnitude of investment that's essential to putting the projects on the ground that will address the pollution that's currently reaching our rivers, lakes, ponds, and streams.
One entity that was keeping a very close eye on what Vermont was doing this session was the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And last week, your office got a letter from the EPA in which they gave an official thumbs up to Vermont's long-term funding plan for Lake Champlain, at least. Why do we have to care so much about what EPA thinks about what we're doing when it comes to water quality funding in Vermont?
Sure. Well, in order to answer that question, we have to reflect back to 2015, 2016. EPA was reviewing the pollution budget for Lake Champlain that was in place at that time, sometimes referred to as a TMDL, or total maximum daily load. And in reaching agreement with the state of Vermont about how to put in place a robust pollution reduction framework for Lake Champlain, we agreed to a suite of 28 milestones. Included in that suite of 28 milestones were a bunch of different regulatory programs related to stormwater, agriculture, and wastewater, but also a commitment to ensure that we would have the resources available to implement those projects. And the funding piece that was the final outstanding milestone on that fairly lengthy list. And so EPA has been waiting for the state of Vermont to put in place a framework. And so it was really exciting to receive that letter last week and have their endorsement.
So you've got a raft of new money to work with. How are you going to spend it?
So that is a great question. About two-thirds of that money actually is reviewed and considered by the Clean Water Board. The Clean Water Board is comprised of secretaries of five agencies, myself, the Agency of Agriculture, Transportation, Commerce and Community Development, as well as the Secretary of Administration, and four members of the public. We've actually just kicked off a process looking at our next year's budget and are soliciting feedback from the public about the ways to prioritize our investments. Certainly, we have statutory obligations and other requirements that necessitate certain types of investments, but we do also have a degree of flexibility and want to make sure that we hear from the public about how they would like to see those dollars invested. At the end of the day, these dollars go out in the ground in the form of grants. They go out in the ground providing subsidized loans to municipalities to implement stormwater and wastewater improvements. And at times, they go out on the ground to individual land owners to purchase easements and actually change the use of a particular parcel of land that's particularly in a sensitive area.
I want to turn our attention now to somebody who is dealing with the effects of some of these algal blooms on the ground level. Diana Wood is the Marketing and Outreach Manager for the City of Burlington's Department of Parks, Recreation, and Waterfront. So far this month, Diana's department has had to shut down one or more beaches on 6 days due to water quality issues. Diana is with us on the phone now to help us understand this problem a little better. Diana, thanks for joining Vermont Edition today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So are the beach closures that you're seeing in Burlington this summer any more prevalent than what you've had to deal with in the past?
So far, we're off to a good, bad start, I'd say. In 2018, we only saw about 4 days of beach closure. We're already at more than that. So, and we're only towards the end of July. So who knows what, you know, August will bring. It seems very weather dependent.
And is there any way to predict these things, to have a sense of whether or not there is going to be a big problem as it relates to these algae blooms? I mean, is it the heat that is the big factor, water levels that are the big factor?
It seems to be hot, still days are when the algae is most likely to bloom. I was looking at numbers back from 2016 when the lake levels were really, really low. And it was really, really hot and dry. And we had like 17 and a half days of like beach closures. So I would say that the weather is very a significant factor in closing beaches.
So in my head right now, I'm imagining the look on the faces of kids on a hot summer day who show up at the beach ready to go into the water, cool off, have fun, play Marco Polo, whatever it is they want to do, only to find out that that water is off limits to them. How does your department try to deliver a fun parks experience to visitors under those kinds of circumstances?
Well, fortunately, even though when we close the beaches, the rest of the park is still remaining open. They're welcome to play on the sand, and then they have all the grassy areas and things like that. So it's not – we don't close the park. We just advise people to stay out of the water. So there's plenty of opportunities for people to have fun, just not as cooling.
And do you notice a noticeable dip in attendance when the water actually is closed off to folks?
Probably. Although, fortunately, like by the time you close them, it's usually later in the afternoon, and sometimes the next day they're reopened. So the actual impacts of a beach closure are pretty short.
So I know that a lot of people are of the belief that these water closures are the result of some kind of human sewage in the water. You say that's a misconception that you'd like to rectify?
Yeah, that is one of the most popular comments we get every time I have to share it. And the people automatically connect wastewater runoff with the algal blooms. And that's, from what I've been told, is not really the case. Wastewater only accounts for about 3% of the load. So it's really overall conditions in the lake that are causing our beaches to be prone to blue-green, to cyanobacteria blooms. And so that's the struggle to communicate to people, that there is a multitude of things happening in the conditions of our lake, and to really try to understand all the science behind it and the safety precautions of it too, to really understand what happens. Like, is it safe to swim at later that day, or if they swim earlier in that day, you know, they ask like, oh, was it okay? And So trying to educate the public is always a challenge.
As you look at the plan of action that elected officials have put together, that people like Secretary of Natural Resources Julie Moore are going to be responsible for executing, what level of confidence do you have from where you sit that these sorts of activities are actually going to solve the problems that you're dealing with in Burlington?
I'm definitely hopeful that all of the programs in place and the plans in place will have a positive impact on the lake health. And I know that it takes an entire community of people and scientists and landowners and farmers to make this happen. And I can speak for the city of Burlington and our roles in it. We're definitely happy to work within these programs to make these, to have successful impact.
Diana Wood is the Marketing and Outreach Manager for the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Waterfront in Burlington. Diana, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yes, thank you.
So, Julie, you are all too aware of the problems that Burlington is dealing with this summer, other communities as well. Now that Vermont has embarked on this clean water initiative, is it just a matter of when, not if, we're going to stop dealing with these algal blooms in our lakes? Or is there a possibility that 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, we're talking to Diana or her successor again about beach closures in Burlington?
Well, certainly the goal of this work is to reduce the frequency and the intensity of the algal blooms, which has been particularly pronounced this summer. I think the ability to guarantee that we can eliminate them is a tall order, but that's certainly the direction we're pushing in. There are a suite of conditions on the landscape, as Diana alluded to, that contribute phosphorus pollution to our lake. They are generally weather-driven. So she's correct in saying only about 3% of all the phosphorus that reaches Lake Champlain each year is coming from wastewater treatment plants. The vast majority of it is runoff from the land. It's runoff from our roads and parking lots. It's runoff from our farm fields, even from our forests. That's contributing the remainder, that 97% of all phosphorus reaching the lake. And so in this period of changing climate, where we're seeing more frequent and intense rainfall events and more runoff as a result, it's really hard to make those sort of guarantees because I don't know what the future weather holds for us. But we know we're doing the right types of projects. We now have the resources to do them with the right magnitude. And we fully anticipate seeing a significant reduction in the frequency and intensity of blooms.
We have a caller on the line. Peter is with us from Burlington. Peter, what's on your mind today?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I think it's all to the good that phosphorus inputs to the lake are being monitored and regulated. But there's also another aspect of phosphorus in solution in the lake, and that is the phosphorus that's absorbed on the sediments. And these buffer the level of phosphorus in the solution. And so it may be that we need to do some research to see how strong that effect is. I know an experiment was done in the Netherlands years ago in which they got a cylinder of plastic they set down in a polluted estuary, and they pumped the water of the estuary out and replaced it with low phosphorus water. And it didn't take long for the phosphorus in the sediments to re-equilibrate with this low phosphorus water to put in and jack the phosphorus level right back up to what it had been.
Peter, thanks so much for the call. I know the science of water quality and pollution remediation is evolving in real time, Julie. What do you think about what Peter had to say there about phosphorus?
He's absolutely right. There is an important body of work to be done to look at those legacy phosphorus sediments that are already in the lake. We know that our first priority has to be to turning off the spigot, so to speak, to doing the work in the watershed to reduce the amount of phosphorus that's reaching Lake Champlain and the tributary rivers and streams each year. But ultimately, to achieve our water quality goals, I would say there's a growing recognition that we're going to need to do some work in the lake itself. We have a pilot project this year that was turned on just last month up at Lake Carmi doing one of those types of interventions. We've installed a fairly extensive aeration system in Lake Carmi, trying to keep oxygen at the bottom of the lake at the sediment water interface, because we know having oxygen there keeps phosphorus stuck to sediments and doesn't let it come back up into the water column like the caller described.
And how dramatic do you think the improvements on Lake Carmi are going to be as a result solely of that aeration system?
Frankly, if it was only the aeration system, I don't think it would work. The reason we were confident in moving forward with the aeration system at this point in time is because of the good work that's been done throughout the watershed by the campers, by the town of Franklin, and by the farmers that all have a different role to play. We had estimated 10 years ago that we needed to see a 40% reduction in the amount of phosphorus being delivered from the watershed to the lake. We believe that that's been achieved, and as a result, we're willing to move forward with the aeration system. This is the first year. We're still working out some kinks, and I know there are reports of algal blooms on Lake Carmi currently, but we do believe that ultimately this will provide some relief to folks who love to recreate on that lake.
We're going to be joined now by Vermont's state auditor, Doug Hoffer. Just this month, he released a report on the cost-effectiveness of state spending on clean water efforts in Lake Champlain between 2016 and 2018. You can find a link to that report on vpor.org. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Pete.
You are of the opinion, Doug Hoffer, that Vermont is not getting the most bang for its buck when it comes to water quality investments, so far at least. Where's the money going, and why, in your view, is that the wrong place to spend it?
Well, we looked at data from the Department of Environmental Conservation that they provided on expenditures by project type, whether it's ag, roads, natural resources, wastewater, and so forth, and compared that to their estimates of the reduction in phosphorus. It's a pretty simple calculation. We're not scientists, but these two numbers are pretty straightforward, although I gather there's still evolving science on measuring the phosphorus reductions. But in the end, we found that, not surprisingly, the heavy bricks and mortar capital intensive projects like wastewater were not reducing phosphorus to the extent per dollar as some of the other softer approaches. And that was troubling because, as the secretary pointed out, wastewater is only responsible for 3 or 4% of all the phosphorus. So it seemed odd that so much money was directed to that particular approach. I now understand from the secretary and others that part of it is that there were decisions made early on when capital funds were the primary source, not the only, but the major source of money. So as had been the case for years, the legislature and the administration directed those funds to programs intended to fund wastewater-related projects. And, you know, the secretary knows well the state has lots of obligations in addition to the need to reduce phosphorus. So for them, it was sort of business as usual. We have to keep doing what we're doing on the wastewater front. But to characterize that as a prudent or strategic investment in phosphorus reduction was off the mark.
Were there other ancillary benefits that we realized because of this spending? I mean, Vermonters have become sadly accustomed to hearing about hundreds of thousands of gallons of partially treated sewage spilling into rivers across the state after heavy rainfalls.
There's no doubt. I'm not questioning the wisdom of making investments in wastewater treatment, but our focus and the focus of the Clean Water Board, the upgraded, newfangled Clean Water Board, is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily phosphorus. That's what the EPA's approach is largely about, although the Federal Clean Water Fund or Act covers a lot of ground. But we asked the question about the effectiveness of investments for reducing phosphorus. That's what we did. The good news is that the legislature and the administration, as was pointed out, now have some, I would say, more flexible funding sources. Although, if you look at the capital budget going forward, the state is going to continue to make these very substantial investments in wastewater, in part, I think, because they get a federal match, which is great. But again, I'm not sure it's fair to characterize those as investments towards reducing phosphorus.
Elected officials have locked in a long-term source of water quality revenue now. In the process of standing up new layers of government to oversee the disbursement of those funds, what do you think Vermont can do as a state, Doug Hoffer, to make sure that that money is being spent wisely?
Well, I think they should start with the charge given to them by the legislature to the Clean Water Board, which is to ensure that the greatest water quality gain for the investment. And, you know, I gather the bill is going to devolve some responsibility down to regional entities, which may be great. On the other hand, regional entities will be an opportunity for local and regional interests to put their requests on the table, when in fact, I think most people would agree that what we should do is what I just said, spend the money where you get the best bang for the buck.
And how do we ensure accountability for those bucks? I mean, your state auditor, you fulfill part of that oversight role. But how do we make sure that the money that's being spent is delivering the phosphorus reduction benefits that we've been promised?
Well, I think statute requires that the state conduct an audit of all of these activities that's delivered or supposed to be delivered in 2021. And if I'm not mistaken, I think ANR and their partners are now discussing what is going to be the scope of that audit. It could be modest or it could cover everything, and they have to figure that out, what's best for them. But that's one opportunity, so we'll have some more information in 21. We wanted to do this now because it's early in the process, and we thought it might help inform decisions going forward.
Doug Hoffer is the Vermont State Auditor. Doug, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Julie, I want to give you an opportunity to respond directly to what Doug Hoffer and his team found in their report. Is he right? Have we not been getting the kind of phosphorus reduction benefits that we would otherwise want to see from this kind of expenditure?
Sure. As the auditor noted, there really are varying levels of cost efficiency in the pollution reduction projects that the state is required to undertake, with wastewater and stormwater improvements known to be more expensive per pound of phosphorus removed than investments in agriculture or rural roads or natural resources restoration projects. Unfortunately, the state just doesn't have the flexibility to delay or elect not to invest in some of these more expensive phosphorus reduction approaches. The TMDL specifically requires investments across all sectors, as did Act 64, which sometimes we refer to as Vermont's Clean Water Act that was passed by the legislature in 2015, that specifically requires these investments in wastewater occur sooner than some of the other investments we will ultimately be making in these more cost-effective sources. So the idea that they aren't prudent or strategic, I take a little umbrage with, but really I think it's we have to look at all of the obligations the state has, legal as well as this, certainly the obligation to drive down phosphorus pollution loads taken together, in order to arrive at that suite of projects. And we can't afford to be myopic because our approach is an all-in approach and because we have requirements that require us to look at stormwater, wastewater, agriculture all at the same time.
Eric is on the phone from Castleton. Eric, what do you have to say?
Well, I hear you talking about the phosphorus load that's going into the lake, and that's all well and good, and that's what the TMDL is really all about. And I hear some people talking about the overspending on the improvements that are being made to the wastewater sewage treatment plants. But a big benefit that I haven't heard talked about are the other parts of the waste system that the improvements to those wastewater sewage treatment plants are going to help eliminate, which would be all of the pharmaceuticals that are being taken by everybody up in the Burlington and the whole corridor where most of our state lives. You guys can talk about that and see the improvement that's going to come from getting those chemicals out of the water before we start seeing weird-looking fish and frogs and the whole rest of the nine yards.
Thanks for the call, Eric. Julie Moore, what's being done on that front?
Sure. Pharmaceuticals and personal care products, as well as other emerging contaminants, are things we think a lot about. Part of our challenge in wastewater treatment is that our processes are largely biological. Some of those things are really well removed during wastewater treatment, and others aren't or require specific modifications and adjustments to the plants. But the caller is right. Wastewater treatment provides an incredibly valuable service in service of public health that goes well beyond reducing phosphorus pollution.
We got a question from D-Light on VPR.org. He said, you know, we hear a lot about agricultural runoff reduction. We hear a lot about treatment of wastewater treatment plants. D-Light wants to know, what can homeowners and people who are just using the land and waterways do to personally help reduce the growth of algae in our lakes and ponds, something that would be totally apart from what's being undertaken on the state by the state?
Sure. I think one of the most effective things individual landowners can do is look for opportunities to soak rainwater away on their property. Say, as a society, we've spent a lot of time in engineering trying to figure out how to get water away from our homes as quickly as possible between gutters and paved driveways that connect to roads, to catch basins, to pipes. What we really need to do is look for ways to slow that water down and soak it in. And so to the extent you have gutters on your roofs and can turn out your downspout so it runs out over your lawn as opposed to down your driveway, that's fantastic. Rain barrels are another low-cost practice that homeowners can implement. Use that water then to water their gardens or meet other water needs, non-potable water needs around their house. Also, to the extent folks live on a lakeshore or near a river or a stream, allowing that vegetation to grow up a little higher, not mowing right down to the water's edge, is an important practice. 80% of the land in Vermont is privately owned. And so to the extent individual landowners can create more natural conditions right up against rivers, lakes, ponds, and streams, we all benefit.
We're talking, Julie Moore, a lot about Lake Champlain today. Lake Carmi got mentioned because these are sort of the epicenters of the blue-green algae problem in Vermont. But Vermont's water quality problems are not confined to those areas. The Department of Environmental Conservation maintains a lake scorecard on its website. And a quick look at that scorecard shows that there are deteriorating water quality conditions in dozens of lakes. And we're talking about some pretty prominent bodies of water, Lake Willoughby in Westmore, Caspian in Greensboro, two jewels of the Northeast Kingdom. What is the state doing to address problems in those watersheds?
Well, so you're right. There are a lot more lakes in Vermont than just Lake Champlain. In fact, there are roughly 800 lakes in the state. About half of those are bigger than 10 acres in size, so a fairly significant size. I would say the good news is Vermont has some of the best lakes in the nation with respect to water clarity and nutrient levels. 95% of our lakes are in good condition with respect to nitrogen. Two-thirds are in good condition with respect to phosphorus, and only 7% of them have been identified as being in poor condition. A lot of the challenges we see in our lakes and ponds are again, back to some of those comments I made to the previous caller about ensuring that we have good, robust vegetation growing along the water's edge. Some of our challenges are associated with those shallow water habitats and shoreland condition, and those are things that are really within the control of individual landowners. The state did put in place shoreland protection requirements several years ago that we are hopeful will help move the needle in the right direction. But because the vast majority of our shoreland and river corridor areas are owned by private landowners, we would love the public's assistance in thinking twice before mowing and cutting vegetation in those areas.
Act 76, passed earlier this year, of course, created this long-term funding mechanism. It also spells out how that money is going to be dispersed. And what elected officials have landed on is this really kind of interesting network of new regional entities, things that don't exist right now, and I gather is your job to figure out what they're going to look like, who is going to be running them. Doug Hoffer raised some concerns that a lot of other folks have had, is that when you put that decision-making power at the local level, you potentially have a lot of interesting local politics that crop up and sort of alter the dynamic in not necessarily positive ways in terms of how that money is going to be spent. What are those clean water service providers going to look like, and how are you going to make sure that they do an effective and efficient job of getting the money out the door?
So I'm going to start with the second half of your question, and then we'll talk a little bit about what clean water service providers are going to look like. But in terms of ensuring that we're getting the best work done on the ground, part of Act 76, in addition to creating clean water service providers, requires the state of Vermont to establish a pollution reduction formula. So essentially, my agency is going to be looking at each major river basin going into Lake Champlain and determining how many pounds of phosphorus need to be reduced from the types of projects that would be managed by these clean water service providers each year. We're not turning over the full book of work to clean water service providers. They have just the non-regulatory components. So my agency will continue to administer stormwater and wastewater permits, the municipal roads general permit, manage the accepted management practices for forestry, and the like. like, but these non-regulatory or voluntary projects, largely natural resources restoration projects, are what will be the purview of the Clean Water Service providers. And we're going to give them a target in terms of the number of pounds of phosphorus that we expect to be reduced. We will have calculators available to them to determine the value, relative value of different projects, and we will be paying based on the pounds of phosphorus, no longer based on the project. And I am confident that that framework will provide the exact sort of accountability that's necessary in order for us to ensure we get the job done. In order to get to that place, we do have to stand up clean water service providers. And we have are just about to kick off a public-facing process. We anticipate ultimately building to a request for proposals, so soliciting people who would be interested in performing that clean water service provider service to the state. But we'll be working with partners in watershed groups, regional planning commissions, conservation districts, among others, over the next few months to scope out a request for proposals that can ultimately be issued to identify entities that would be interested in filling that clean water service provider role.
We have an email question from Judy in South Aalborg, and she wants to know if Vermont is in any cooperative agreements with Canada and New York when it comes to cleaning up Lake Champlain specifically, I imagine, because all of them obviously border that lake. Do we have any memorandums of understanding or other formal agreements with New York and Canada over what's being done in Lake Champlain?
We do. We have both formal and informal agreements with New York and Canada. Most of that work is coordinated through the Lake Champlain Basin Program, which is a quasi-federal entity. It's headquartered up in Grand Isle and serves that coordinating function between the three jurisdictions. Probably the most well-known component of its coordination is all of the monitoring work that's done on Lake Champlain, ensuring that data collected in New York is comparable to data collected in Vermont and Quebec, so we can have a complete picture of water quality within the lake. But we also work together on sharing project ideas and approaches, ensuring consistent regulatory approaches. New York and Vermont agreed to the original pollution budget for Lake Champlain that was developed back in 2002. Ours was since updated by EPA, but work continues apace in the agreements that were reached at that time.
And Lake Memphremagog, of course, has its own host of issues. Similar arrangements with Canada on that?
It does. We have a steering committee. It doesn't have the this 501c3 organization that provides that coordination. But we work closely with the province of Quebec in ensuring a shared approach to addressing water quality concerns in Lake Memphremagog.
Your agency recently sent out a release asking regular Vermonters to participate in this process. The Clean Water Board, which is an entity that ultimately is going to decide how to disperse a lot of this water quality money, is holding a public hearing on August 22nd. You're encouraging people to come out, offer their opinions. How is that public sentiment going to figure into the decisions that Clean Water Board is going to make?
Obviously, there are a myriad of different considerations that go into how we balance our budget. The cost-effectiveness piece that the auditor has raised, the statutory obligations we have under state and local law, or state and federal law, as well as priorities within communities. And our hope is in having this public hearing and providing an opportunity from public comment to hear from Vermonters about how they would prioritize our work across the various sectors. Investments in stormwater management, wastewater treatment, agricultural conservation, and natural resources restoration. Hearing from members of the public will be a factor that we take into our deliberations in figuring out how to ultimately distribute those resources. We know that this is a $2 billion book of work that's going to take 20 years to complete. So we have choices about what goes first and really value input from the community about where they would have us go first.
Julie Moore is the Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources. Julie, thanks again for being a part of our program today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.